All right, we're recording on Thursday, the week before this episode's released, because I'm going to be doing some beach travel for the summer. I'll still be working, but it's a kind of a work getaway. And so we're talking about the breaking news of the day because the news gods gave us that, and we have that. And then later on in the show, we'll answer some of those hashtag ask 9to5Mac questions that we've been receiving over the last couple of weeks. So thanks, everyone, for sending those. First at Mayo, let's talk about the latest report from supply chain analyst Ming-Chi Kuo of TF International Securities. So Kuo has a new report out today. I covered the story. It's all about Apple keyboards. Well, at least for the MacBook line and the iPad line, which has a smart keyboard, so it's included. What's your summary of this?
Yeah, so obviously, a few weeks ago, Kuo had the report about his first report on the Scissor Switch keyboard rollout, talking about it's going to be a new keyboard that isn't the Butterfly, isn't identical to the keyboards they had, you know, the 2015 and early keyboards, because it's going to be infused with glass fiber or something for strength. And in that report, he said it was going to come out first in the 2019 MacBook Air and then partially refreshed MacBook Pros, then other computers in the future, right? But that was all before the July back to school product announcement, where Apple obviously revved the 1299 MacBook Pro and the MacBook Air, which then cast some doubt on the Kuo report. And we talked about this at the time. Like, you know, Kuo's not always right, but he's pretty good. And this was so far, this just seemed, as soon as the MacBook Air announcement came out, and obviously those computers came out with the third generation Butterfly keyboard with new materials, not a scissors key switch or anything like that, it just felt really wonky for there to then also be another MacBook Air change, you know, 3 months later, or even MacBook Pro changes, because we had them in May. Like, it was a bit, you know, a bit wacky. So What Kuo has essentially come out today is saying, oh, I've changed my mind, I've revised my error report, and now his outlook is essentially the common sense, you know, what you probably guess path, which is basically saying that the scissor key keyboard will first come to the 16-inch MacBook Pro in the fourth quarter of the year. Obviously, the rumored, you know, high-end MacBook Pro iteration that would go above the 15-inch in the lineup, and then come to all other Mac laptops across 2020. And if you were, you know, a guessing man, that's probably closer to where you'd be versus this weird, wonky, oh, MacBook Air, blah, 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 blah. Like, now it's basically, right, so the new hardware revision's coming in with the 16-inch, and then there will be hardware updates to the rest of the line in 2020, which will, you know, push the Butterfly eventually out of the line and everything will be scissor switches.
Yeah, this kind of fixes the idea. I mean, we could still entertain the idea that maybe there's a real MacBook Air refresh coming later in the year, because this MacBook Air refresh, it got a new screen type where you have true tone display, so the screen adjusts to the color temperature of the room, but not a faster processor, and actually got cheaper, slightly slower SSDs, which helped bring the cost down. But we could imagine maybe there'd be a higher tier of MacBook Air come out that costs a little bit more for that model, and that has the new keyboard. But this makes a lot more sense. So that there is the 16-inch, which is all new screen size, and, you know, presumably design around that. And that's got the new style. And then at some point next year, both the MacBook Air and MacBook Pro, just at some point in the year, they also moved to the new classic old keyboard style. And the glass thing makes me think that maybe that layer is to try and retain, like, do you know the video where Phil Schiller introduces the MacBook, 12-inch MacBook in 2015, and he's showing like the like fingered slow motion typing on a keyboard, and it's like silly how dramatic it is, but like it's super wobbly on the scissor switch and it's super stable and you've got more room to type because the keys are larger, that they can do that anyway. But like the comparison was like that old keyboard is sloppy and the new keyboard is cleaned up. Like it's a better typing experience. Maybe they can retain what they showed in the video of like, you don't get the keys moving halfway, like over, you know, kind of sloshing around. And you could kind of feel that in typing, like for sure. Like it's definitely like more mush to type on the old keyboard style than even the Magic keyboards for, you know, desktop computers or Apple's standalone keyboard. in that.
Yeah, like this kind of rigidity or stability is more than just a function of low travel. Like,
right.
There's like a wobble, right, that it eliminates.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I think like, if you look at the Magic Keyboard that Apple sells today, like the one that's got the Lightning port and not batteries inside, I think that one, I don't think they've ever done a video for that, but you could probably replicate kind of the same benefits. And it's got the same like larger keycaps with less room in between each one. And so maybe you replicate with that glass, you know, whatever surface inside, you replicate the same, you know, feeling of typing. You just don't have the sloshing.
Yeah, because I think in the 2015 like announcement of the MacBook, obviously it's the keynote's marketing, so it's a market video, right?
Sure. Yeah.
It kind of attributed the lack of stability to the switches. They were like, these scissor switches are old and cranky and they make everything wobble.
Yeah.
And now we've got Butterfly, which are like evenly proportioned and evenly, you know, hold the weight across the entire key, and therefore mm-hmm. you get the stability. Maybe that was true in 2015 and they didn't have a better idea at the time, but it doesn't seem like a fact of nature that that's the only way that they could achieve, you know, more stable keycaps. And I like the stable keycaps. I'm a proponent of the Butterfly keyboard in general, part, you know, aside from the reliability issues. Yeah. Like, I like how the current MacBook keyboards feel, and I'm not opposed to it.
Mm-hmm.
But clearly the, you know, obviously number one priority is reliability.
Yeah.
And then there are, you know, a decent segment of the market that are upset with the extreme low travel of, you know, the current keyboards. And so maybe this new scissor switch keyboard, you know, balances that up a bit. Like maybe you have more travel, but the keys are stable. So, you know, both people are, both camps are happy in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure the glass fiber, like Quo called it like reinforced by glass fiber. So it's not like you're going to look at the keys and they're going to be glass. Like they're still going to be plastic or whatever keycaps, right?
It'll just
be whatever mechanism inside rather than being some weird metal alloy. Maybe they're made of glass or something, you know, something along those lines.
Yeah, that's one of the fun things we were talking about just today in news coverage was sort of how we tell the story of the keyboard evolution, because we realize that most consumers don't know the difference between Butterfly switch and scissor switch because they don't watch the marketing keynotes and they don't make it super clear on the website, today at least, which is which. And you've got to just kind of know the jargon to know what's going on. And we didn't know the scissor switch before scissor switch was going out the door, you know, so we all learned at the same time too.
Yeah. Yeah. Apple made everyone care about suddenly what mechanism their laptop keyboard was made of.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And like in the early days of the keyboard situation, like people just, there was a certain camp who didn't like the way it felt, but there was not the reliability thing because not that many people were switching from a MacBook Pro to a MacBook. And people were reluctant to give up their MacBook Air for a MacBook. And this also helps me kind of understand why the MacBook is just gone and not replaced so far, at least. The MacBook Air is thicker than the MacBook and it's a lot more volume. So I've heard people say maybe the MacBook goes away because they can't do the new keyboard in that casing. And I've not really felt like that's correct, but, maybe so, just based on how fast they're going to transition this. It's going to be fall and then maybe, you know, by summer it's done. And by eliminating new sales of the MacBook, that program can just be for, they'll finally have a situation where they have a new computer, a new MacBook that's not in the keyboard repair program. And maybe in the future they can bring back the MacBook form factor, you know, when it has so many changes, like maybe the processor's ARM, and it's got way better battery life and more power because it's got like the power of iPad Pros and not the power of like low end Intel chips. But we'll see about that. But at least for the, you know, Quo's timeline now, it seems like if the keyboard's a concern and you plan on using your keyboard for more than 4 years, or you don't want to randomly have to service your keyboard, then those are the laptops to wait for, it seems like, you know, and it's kind of untimely.
Yeah, you're close to finally having a resolution to this years long issue, whether you're, you know, annoyed at reliability or just like feel.
And hopefully the new keyboard, even if they go back to it, hopefully scissor switches is the
people
fix.
People like it.
Yeah. And the glass, you know, in Sarah Center, isn't problematic, and the spacing isn't problematic, because I mean, it would be terrible if this continues. Because it's been so bad to cover. Like, I'm over it, but also I'm typing double spaces when I'm doing professional emails, and you know, I'm having the issues myself, so I can't say it's nothing. And then this iPad angle on Quo's report wasn't a whole lot to it. It's just that he says a few things. He says that he believes that the productivity improvements in software with iPad OS 13 will encourage more people to switch from, you know, like Windows laptops and cheap laptops to iPads, and that the smart keyboard is a big part of that, because then you're closer to replicating a notebook, and that he thinks that will drive smart keyboard adoption over time. I think his numbers were like, the smart keyboard will ship in 2 million this year, and then 4 million next year, and then 7 million in 2021.
Yeah, he said currently there's only 5% of iPads come with keyboards, or are sold and have keyboards with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you expect that to climb as the iPad becomes more... I mean, they've been pushing this as a laptop replacement for a long time now, but maybe they're finally, you know, shipping what people really want. And I found a few other things interesting. I think he calls the switch style there, like, was it dome covered?
Yeah, dome switches.
Yeah. So, but he also had mentioned that those are more expensive to produce, so they can't make as well. They just cost more to produce, but they also have you make more money from selling them because you can price them high. So that's something. But
yeah, and apparently the manufacturer of the smart keyboard will also be the manufacturer of the new scissor switch keyboard.
Blame the manufacturer for all the problems. Yeah.
But the manufacturer of the scissor switch keyboard is not the manufacturer of the butterfly keyboard. So
yeah.
And you will.
Yeah. So just to clarify, this year, like, only the 16 MacBook Pro is expected to have the fixed keyboard, and we expect that to start from around $3,000 and up. So, some of the report was a little bit unclear to me, but was he predicting like hundreds of thousands of sales for that model, and then millions of, you know, hundreds of millions? Did you interpret
his... He said 400,000 scissor switch keyboards will be manufactured this year.
Okay.
And obviously, if they're only going onto the one laptop, that means 400,000.
Okay.
16 inches.
Yeah. Okay. And then next year, in the year following it, it becomes in the millions. So
it ramps up, because obviously then they're on all the laptops.
Yeah. And so next year we'll have kind of a half and half scenario, where this year we've got like a small percentage of MacBooks sold with the good keyboard. Hopefully it's good. The next year, there's a leftover from 2019 until it gets refreshed. And then by the end of the year, it will all be the new keyboard style. And on January 1st, 2021, it will have been done. And so for that entire year, everything is the new keyboard style. Okay. Let's also talk about this breaking news today, which is kind of confirmation to that recent report that Apple was interested in spending a lot of money on Intel's modem business and owning it. And so that's been officially announced now. What are the details there?
Yeah, so Apple is acquiring Intel's modem division. They say almost all of Intel's modem division, smartphone modem business, which is a $1 billion transaction expected to complete by the end of the year, obviously subject to regulatory approval and stuff, but it's likely to go ahead. And that will mean Apple gets a load of intellectual property, so a big pile of patents. They get some equipment, and all approximately 22,200 Intel employees will become Apple employees to join Tsurugi's hardware business to work on Apple cellular modems.
Mm-hmm.
2,200 people is a lot. Like,
mm-hmm.
That's a lot of people.
Like, what are the numbers whenever they say that they're going to like make a new campus and grow the number of jobs? Like, you know, it's in that ballpark, right? Like,
I think, yeah, well, so they have 130,000 employees total, but then, you know, two-thirds of those are retail employees. So you have 40,000 corporate employees. If you add 2,200 to 40,000, that's like a 5% increase in headcount just from one acquisition, mm-hmm. essentially. It's a pretty big jump.
Yeah. Remember, it was December last year, 2018, where they said that they were going to build a new $1 billion campus in Austin, Texas, and that would create thousands of jobs across the USA. So I guess maybe they're looking at, like, you know, not just Apple, but affected companies too in the chain. Apple says it added 6,000 U.S. jobs in 2018 alone, and employees 90,000 across all 50 states. That was just from that. They said that they will create 20,000 jobs in the U.S. by 2023 from that Austin campus. I don't think that's just Apple employees. I think they mean like in other, you know, it branches from that.
Indirectly.
Yeah, exactly. So, and that was over several years. In this one case, they had, you know, a couple thousand people overnight.
Yeah, that's a big group. Like, mm-hmm. surely Johnny Cerugi's, you know, hardware technology group at the moment doesn't have 2,000 employees in it, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Well, at least the subsection working on chips, right? Like, that's a lot mm-hmm. of people to be working solely on. I guess that just highlights how hard making modems is, right? Like, if yeah. you need a division of 2,200 people to do it at Intel, then
yep.
that's a big group, and that's a, you know, that's why the only competitors in the space are Qualcomm, and then Intel, when, you know, clearly regarded second place until they've given up on it. So
mm-hmm.
it just kind of shows the magnitude of the problem, and obviously Apple's acquisition here will presumably accelerate, you know, not be a hindrance, but be a helper to getting Apple-designed modems for iPhones into the supply chain faster, because they're going to be using Intel this year because the deal's already signed. Then next year, they're going to be using Qualcomm modems, and then they'll be carrying on using Qualcomm modems until they have their own Apple modem ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
We heard that this could take many, many years, like 2023, 2025. Now that they actually have, you know, 2,200 employees that are talented in this particular space and specialized in this space, plus they have the massive patent portfolio behind them, I'm sure that helps get around some big legal issues or, you know, royalty problems.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably, we will see, you know, an Apple design modem in the iPhone sooner than now than 2025. Like, it's yeah. gotta be, they wouldn't have bought it otherwise, you know, what would be the point?
Yeah, I mean, my take last week was when this was just you know, reported as like an advanced talks with Intel, that surely Apple would ship their own modem without buying Intel. Like, that wasn't the problem. They didn't need to buy them for this to happen. It just so happened that their Intel's modems were kind of bad and they weren't making progress with 5G, And even when Apple had iPhones with Intel and Qualcomm, Qualcomm was the superior modem to have. You just didn't know what you had without, you know, trying to look at the model number or something. And so, so for that reason, like, I feel like, you know, now that this is official, they didn't have to buy Intel, even though Intel was failing. It's probably in part to prevent a competitor from buying Intel. Although, you know, that still wouldn't stop Apple from having their own modem in their own time. The one thing I found interesting in the official release is they say that they'll hold over 17,000 wireless technology patents, but I don't think they say how many they had before Intel, like how much is part of Intel. So we just have 17,000 patents after the acquisition closes, they expect by the end of the year, but we don't know how many they had, how many are from Intel. So that doesn't give us a great idea of how much the acquisition helps with patents even. It just seems like, you know, they have a large number of patents.
Yeah, and it says that Intel will retain the ability to develop modems for anything that isn't a smartphone, basically.
Yeah. Like,
and they even say autonomous vehicles.
Yes.
I guess that means that it doesn't say Intel's retaining exclusive rights. So I assume if Apple wants to, they can make their own modems for their own, you know, for Project Titan if they want to still. But this mm-hmm. is just like, it's part of this $1 billion deal. Apple's like, you know, what we want you for, we want you for the phone modems. That's our priority at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
You can carry on doing, you know, this random stuff that we don't care about for the time being.
Yeah. So they
obviously push the price down.
Yeah. Non-smartphone applications such as PCs, Internet of Things devices, and autonomous vehicles. What an interesting specific list. Is an Apple Watch a non-smartphone application, like, you know, or a smartwatch in general? At first, my read on that was like, wait, does that mean that Apple's no closer to making a modem for Macs if they wanted to have that? And, you know, but I think your read's right that both can. And it just means that Intel won't do smartphones. And when the Qualcomm news broke, where Apple settled with Qualcomm and Intel so that they were going to step out of the smartphone business, and they were going to, I think, look at their existing modem business and see what they want to, you know, stick around with. I guess this is like the final chapter on that. You know, what they didn't want.
Yeah,
goes
for Apple. Yeah, for Apple, Qualcomm was the damage control short term solution to the.
Sure.
We want an iPhone with 5G out soon, and, you know, Intel's not going to give it to us. And now this acquisition is just accelerating Apple's long term plan of having their own modem. Because yeah. if Intel hadn't been terrible or hadn't faced problems, Apple would have just carried on using Intel modems until they switched to their own.
Sure,
and yeah. now they're using Qualcomm modems until they switch to their own, and now they can switch their own sooner because they have more talent on board. Today's episode of Happy Hour is brought to you by Hyper, and specifically its brand new 9-port USB-C hub. The new hub launched just last week. The new 9-in-1 Hyperdrive hub was specifically designed for iPad Pro, MacBook Pro, and MacBook Air. It features an extended 9-inch long USB-C cable. This means it can sit flat on a table or other surface whilst you use your iPad. USB-C hubs with shorter cables means they're left dangling around in the air, hanging off the iPad. It's just a mess. Not so with the Hyperdrive hub. The hub includes a HDMI port, which you can use to connect to a display and output 4K at 30Hz, gigabit Ethernet for wide internet access, a micro SD card slot for importing your photos, a USB-C pass-through port, three USB-A ports, and a 3.5mm headphone audio jack. The headphone jack does not turn off the iPad's internal speaker until headphones are actually connected, so it doesn't become an annoyance if that jack is unused. The hub supports USB-C pass-through charging rated at 60 watts, so you can comfortably connect a power cable to the USB-C port on the hub and charge your iPad or MacBook while simultaneously taking advantage of the I/O ports on the Hyperdrive hub. All of this comes in a super slim package, a nice design that fits in the palm of your hand. Hyper is great, we love them, so have a look at the Hyperdrive hub. Check out the new Hyperdrive Power 9-in-1 USB-C hub. Find the link in the show notes to find out more. Thanks again to Hyper for sponsoring the show.
All right, Mayo, the next thing in the notes that we share is Zach's August 2019 Mac kit. So what's the story there?
I have no idea.
Okay.
Do you want to enlighten me on this?
Yeah, I think I put MacKit. Yeah, I think I put MacKit in there as like just to throw you off my trail. I have a new iPad Pro. It's the 12.9-inch iPad Pro 256 with cellular and a space gray. So that's that.
Which you used to own, right?
Yeah, I think that was the first one I bought. And I was like, I'm gonna do that one. And then I went back and forth so many times on like what I want this to be. It comes down to this, and this the reason I put August 2019 is because everything's subject to change. So this is like what I'm using August. But I've been doing a lot of like working in coffee shops and public places where it's kind of like enhances my mood and productivity, and I feel like more turned on and more engaged. And some places have decent Wi-Fi. Some places have Wi-Fi, but it's unusable. Like I had an Airbnb a few weeks ago that had Wi-Fi, but you couldn't even like stream Netflix on a TV with it. It was so bad. You definitely couldn't do work on it. So I've been using a lot of hotspot, and I have unlimited data on my cellular plan for my phone. And it includes hotspot, but hotspot is not unlimited. And last month I hit a data cap from hotspot where it was like you've got 3 days left and your hotspot speeds will be super slow where it's unusable until the next month rolls over. And that's with unlimited data, but hotspot is not unlimited. Sometimes the things that I'm doing on hotspot, like maybe it's like getting between point A and point B. What I often do is like hotspot on my 11-inch iPad Pro and, you know, consume data that way with like watching TweetDeck and Motion and, you know, sort of editing stories and things like that. But it's using hotspot. And so I thought one way around this is if my iPad had cellular built in, then it would not be using this hotspot data pool. And it's all the same data anyway. It's just a little bit more expensive, but, cause it's one more device on the network, but, that's my latest justification for the switch. And then the iPad that I had just goes to family. So I'm not going to bother selling it or anything, but, you know, it will benefit.
So you've literally gone full circle on the iPad Pro that you own.
Yeah. Yeah. I think at first too, I was using the smart keyboard folio with the big iPad because I thought like, you know, this will, if I'm going to get further with using this as like a laptop, you know, it's my laptop when I'm not around the iMac, then I'll want the smart keyboard folio. And that was mostly
true. But you have a MacBook Pro now, right?
Yeah, that was mostly true. But so this time I've got the MacBook Pro. And so that's like the thing. That's like the main device. But if I'm in like a scenario where the iPad makes more sense, whether it's data usage or just the amount of like the type of work I'm doing, then I don't need a keyboard on the iPad. I'm a good. I'm great at using the on-screen keyboard, but I still wanted a case and not like a case, just like the closest thing to a smart cover. And so that's the smart, what is it called? The smart cover folio. So I've got that, and that feels like a great thing. And I still have my Apple Pencil, cause that's for, you know, all iPad Pros that are this generation. And, I'm quite happy, I will say. It's neat to get to use iOS 13 and all the changes there on the smaller and the bigger iPad Pro. And now I've handed off the smaller iPad. So I'm in no way doing two iPad Pros at one time. And it's also about the same size as my MacBook Pro. I mean, it's 12.9 inches versus 13.3 inches. And so things like, sidecar, it's like almost like an exact external display, you know? So I am happier with the situation.
Would you say that iPadOS 13 made you want it more versus just sticking with the, you know, the smaller screen one?
I think either one benefits from the changes, and if they apply to you, that's awesome, and if they don't, then they just don't. But it's not like I can do four apps on screen at one time on the bigger iPad. You can see more of the two split screen apps, you know, you can see like a full height portrait and then like a column on the side, or like half and half, you know, that's nice. But you know, it isn't like you can do like four columns of an app.
Or even three apps.
Yeah. Cause the slide over one, even like, it's really cool that you can do all the cool multitasking stuff with slide over. But that's like one app at a time, and it's covering one of your split screen, you know, apps. So it's not perfect yet. And it's just different from using a Mac. And that's the reason both exist, I guess. But that's the current choice I'm on. No comment about future decisions, but that's the current hardware this month. So and just a reminder, I had the MacBook Air from around spring, and then I just did a trade, like a literal trade with a coworker to MacBook Pro. So that was like no new purchase. This was a new purchase, but I'm quite satisfied with it. And I went from silver to space gray again. So yeah. So now all my stuff matches again. Not that was not a factor. It was all about.
You sure that wasn't the main reason you did it?
It was all about the cellular, but I also went from 64 to 256 again. So it's mostly about the cellular stuff. So. And it's, I found myself, just yesterday, a situation where, I was visiting someone in the hospital, and, I could view everything going on from the iPad with TweetDeck and multiple Twitter columns and Slack on screen and all email alerts. So I was updated on that and messages, and I could move the third app on the screen to be a few different things, just not all at one time. And then on the Mac, I didn't have network access, cause I was thinking I'm going to be more, you know, conservative about using my hotspot data now. And so on that, I could edit happy hour because I didn't need data for that. So I got through the whole process of like having one screen do this thing, kind of overview of like current, and then the other screen be dedicated just to adding the podcast, you know, which is a process. So,
yeah, I mean, I told you this when you got the 12.9 inch the first time last year.
Yes.
That the bigger screen is 100% better than the 11 or the 10.5. Like, it's just way nicer experience. I personally don't get the cellular one. I'm still rocking the 2015 iPad Pro, but I've never once regretted like, oh, I want the smaller one. Like, the bigger screen on it is so nice and so useful. iOS 13, or I guess I should say iPadOS 13. I think the name's stupid.
Yeah.
definitely advances what you can do on the iPad in, you know, a variety of ways, whether it, you know, it's file management or keyboard shortcuts. The three finger stuff is really nice. At least swiping back and forward. I don't know about the pinching and the crunching is, you know, it's okay. Text selection is all right. I still miss the loop. Today I want to kind of concentrate on the multitasking situation. Now, I think both me and you currently have a reputation of being pretty anti iPad multitasking. Ever since the iOS 11 days, when they decided to make it very dependent on drag and drop. iPadOS 13 doesn't address those problems, right? Like, you're still reliant on the drag and drop situation. It's still insanely difficult to multitask with an app that is not on your dock.
I mean, the single improvement to that is that in the slide over app, you can now the gesture on the bottom with the home indicator to where you can swipe back to the previous app and you can swipe up and have like an app history of like what's in your slide over apps, and you can move, you know, with a few taps so that even if it isn't in your dock, but you've really got to configure that in a way that takes foresight, I think, and like just assembly. Well,
the problem with the slide over thing is, you know, it only shows you the things you've had in slide over. It's mm-hmm. not like it's not like an iPhone app switcher where it shows you your history of every single app you've had open, right? Yeah. You can just scroll through and tap one. So it'll only have, if you pull up from, you know, the slide over indicator, you'll only have like five or six apps in that list.
Right? It's kind of flimsy. Like it's, you can put it all together. Like I want to have access to mail, messages, another Safari window, and you know, just pick a few more things like Twitter, Slack, whatever, like things that you want to go in between but not have always in view with what you're working on. But I mean, that's surely dependent on memory. And so if you've got the 1 terabyte iPad Pro with double the memory, then you've got a longer timeline there. But then, you know, it's still flimsy in that, like, it's not like your dock is permanent. Apps aren't going to go out of your dock if you put them there. But in the slide over history, they will. It's not a permanent history, you know, and it could, you know, it's just not like this is a new dock where these are your slide over apps. It's meant more like a history, and that's subject to change.
Yeah, and it will do the like app switchery style thing where it can show you like the thumbnail and then load it again if you tap on it. Like it will take it out of memory and bring it back in dynamically.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually really like the slide over switching between them. You know, just by swiping on the bar to flick between, you know, three or four. I'm loving this. Right, that's one of the biggest changes they've done to 30, and it's really really good. And like you can even do complicated things like you because obviously iPad now can do multiple windows per app. You can have like a messages conversation with you and a message conversation with someone else as separate slide over windows, right? So you don't have to be in this constant model of, oh, you're only switched between messages and something else. You can actually have, you know, multiple conversations open in those multiple slide over windows as well. But it does come with added complexity. And what I find is I forget which apps I had open in slide over versus which apps I had open just in normal multitasking, right? Mm-hmm. So if I put a conversation with you into slide over, when I swipe up from the bottom, you know, not swiping on the slide over, just swiping up from the big bottom of the screen, in that grid of, you know, expose recent apps, that will not have the Zach messages conversation because that's siloed into the history of the slide over view.
Yeah.
So now you almost have two histories to remember, and then you could maybe find messages again in the big screen, navigate to a Zach conversation, and then you realize, you know, like 20 minutes later when you open slide over again, you've actually got the messages open with Zach in slide over and messages open with Zach in the main window. Like, it's not simple, and there's definitely more stuff in your head now you have to kind of juggle around. Mm-hmm. I found that just in general, I forget now to close windows that I have open. Like I use my iPad predominantly. It's an entertainment device. I use it for Twitter. I use it for Safari predominantly, right? Those are my easily top two apps of usage. And what I find now is when I'm in Safari, I lose the fact that I had another window open, right? Like mm-hmm. in the iOS 12, you know, in prior days, you could do split screen on Safari only. They implemented like in a custom way, but that would still only ever be one tile in multitasking. Whereas now you have more than one tile for Safari. And if you don't remember, oh, I need to swipe this away, or I need to, you know, I need to keep my head on it. I find that if I just walk up to my iPad now and do the thing where you long press on Safari and say show all windows, I have like eight windows open that I've just forgotten about, right? Like mm-hmm. I have blank Safari windows with just the favorites page open. There are random tabs that I had open that I forgot about. There's this definitely this like extra mental model of like remembering things now that if you want to have like a cleaner idea of it, like on the phone, you don't have to remember to flick to close apps, right? Like Apple doesn't want you to close apps. But on the iPad now, you know, you have to manually close the windows. Like they don't disappear on their own. They just mm-hmm. they just stay around forever. So you can have like, I bet if you're listening now, right, and you've been using iPadOS 13, if you open an app that you've been doing multiple windows with and do the show windows, you know, I bet there's a good chance there's a window open you didn't know you had to open still. And it's like, I had like random stuff. I had like five copies of Google.com open just in my Safari windows because I'd just forgotten about it, right? Because you close that window, then later you go back to Safari in the dock icon, right, from the home screen. And then it doesn't show you all your windows then. It just opens the most recent one. And then if you split an app into two and have it side by side, you dismiss it by swiping off to the right. That app you swiped off to the side is not gone. that Safari window will now just be in your group of Safari windows that you can find again later. Like,
yeah,
there's definitely more stuff to manage in your head, at least. And if you want to be, you know, if you want to actually have a cleaner experience, you have to like actively close stuff now, right? Where you didn't before. And, you know, I, on the Mac, I never have a time where I'm like, oh, this Safari's window's open and I didn't know about it, right? Like, it just doesn't happen. It's a,
right.
And I don't think it's just a transition period of adjusting to the thing. I think it's just the current way the UI works on the iPad is that those extra windows, you kind of forget about them just naturally because they're still trying to maintain the model for, you know, average customers, normal customers, whatever you want to say,
mm-hmm.
that you can just open one app at a time, close it and open it and close it and open it. And that's fine. But now the multitasking experience is kind of tacked on in a different way where it's like, oh, you have to remember to go into this mode to actually see the multitasking windows. And now when you want to close an app, you can't just let the system deal with it because its windows will now just stay around forever. So you actually have to do like active management. And the OS doesn't like guide you in that direction. It's just every periodically you have to like remember, oh, I should probably go and clean this up now. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I've got a few things to say. So the first thing you won't like, but I'm growing more used to the idea that with each software update, there are like 90 new things that I love and like 5 things that I think are steps back that never get fixed. Like my latest example is the home app and how it manages one accessory that can have like 5 different tiles. And now they're all grouped in and it's gotten worse since I first brought it up on the show, not better. before that, it was like I had this routine on the keyboard in the Photos app on the Mac of like how you zoom in and out of pictures and like, you know, an edit. And they actually did change that, which I was so happy about, which made me feel good. Like I think what I thought was not just me alone. But you know, multitasking is one of those things where like we feel especially passionate about, like we feel like what we believe is the right way forward, not just like on our opinion, but like just like we believe everyone would think it was better if you made, you know, a few changes here and there. Cause like the dock situation where what you multitask with without using command space on a keyboard or going back to Spotlight, like that was an early complaint from a lot of people. People have gotten used to how you do multitasking in the iPad, but it's certainly like a learning curve and it's like you're adapting to what's not really the best. And they still haven't.
People revert to the workaround of just millions of apps in your dock. And mm-hmm. to me, it's untenable. And if you go on apple.com/iPad and you look at the market, the image for the iPad, they do not put all their apps in the dock. They don't do it. And because it's not the way you're meant to use it.
Right. And so I keep hoping that they get they haven't gotten there this year. And the idea of even just like a launch pad icon on the dock and you tap that and you get to like what is your home screen basically would be better. So that's something. For the Safari's thing, I definitely experienced that where I had multiple versions of Safari like penned with another app or just in Safari, or maybe it's like full screen Safari versus like slide over Safari. And then even how you manage that is like, you know, if it's full screen Safari, you've got tabs on the top that you go through to close each one. Or if it's like iPhone Safari and slide over, then those you tap like the button to make the kind of a stack of windows. And so even how you manage those is different. Right. Even how you manage those is different. And for Safari, they kind of have the solution where it's in settings in Safari under closed tabs, where manually is how you have always managed tabs in Safari. But now they have new options for after one day. If a tab has been open for one day, it goes away. Or you can choose 1 week or 1 month. And maybe 1 month is like an okay solution, or even 1 week. 1 day is too aggressive for me because I often keep tabs as like a reading list of things I want to, you know, get back to, or I would have closed it. I'm sticking with manual, but if you do feel like you've got tabs all over the place, then there is a new way to try and fix that, but that only applies to Safari. And so once more apps support this new, you know, you've got multiple versions of the same app in different spaces, that won't address that for you. And the last thing is that, you know, like just to make the iPad work for me as like a replacement for my Mac or even just a laptop and like have the desktop be the, you know, have the Mac be the desktop computer. I don't think that it's much about software and like what's available, but it's just like what I want to be able to do is to have, like windowing and not in the way that it is kind of right now where you manage tiles in different ways, but you never have this like full array of windows that you can just, you know, jump in between. I would love something very much like what's on the Mac, if they could pull it off. Instead, like I think they're getting closer to that through clever solutions, but with each one, each advancement in capability, you know, so you can do more things, it also gets more complicated. And so I think that you and I would be considered pro users. Even pro users are a bit flummoxed about just how you manage all this mentally, because on the Mac, it's like, for me, it's as simple as push up on a trackpad with four fingers, or on the Magic Mouse, double tap with two fingers. And then all the windows that I'm working on right now are in front of me, and I can just pick which one I want to be next, or, you know, command tab, that kind of thing. But on the iPad, if I could push up with four fingers and I see all the apps that I've been doing recently, not like in this multitasking environment, but just like more fluid, like how it is on the Mac, where you can drag them around over each other and you can see like seven windows at a time if they're like certain sizes. That's where I want to go. And I think they're getting closer to something like that, but it's all in clever ways that are more complicated than just like push up with four fingers and you've got like, these are all the windows that you're working with.
Add like a new feature to the model, it then also means that they're hiding more of the model at any one time on screen, because they still have to have ultimately the experience be the app fills the screen. So All of the context of, you know, what else is open, as they keep adding more and more ways to make more stuff open and do stuff more at once, that becomes like, you know, invisible in a sense, and you just kind of have to juggle it in your head, and, you know, that only causes problems.
Yep, and it's the same system on the 7.9-inch iPad as the 12.9-inch iPad, which those seem like very different devices, and it's all under iPad OS, and so they have to retain the single window model because it's one system for all screen sizes. But like on the big iPad, you know, single window is okay for some stuff, but for a lot of situations, it's not ideal, and you want to have at least two things on the screen to make it make sense for you. So
yeah, I have a really like basic way that they could make it better, and because I hate just coming on here and like complaining, so I kind of like, you know, thinking up.
Yeah, and this is not like a rant in the moment. You've had this, we've been saving this for, I think, maybe over a month now.
2 months. Since the iPad OS came out, I've been thinking about this stuff. Mm-hmm. Right. So, as it stands now, you can start multiple windows, you know, until the cows come home. And then you come back to the iPad in an hour's time, right? You've forgotten how many windows you had open. But say I want to open Safari again. I look at my dock, I press Safari, and what it does is it opens the last window from Safari that I used, okay? And it opens that full screen, or obviously, it opens it full screen. At that point, instead, what I think should happen is, if you have multiple windows open from Safari, when you press Safari on the dock from the icon, rather than just opening the last window that came open, it should open the show all windows view, so like the app expose, to show you all of the current Safari windows that are open. Because that screen also includes a plus button. So you'd press Safari, and then it would show, oh, here's your five windows that are open. And then you could either tap on one of those windows to actually maximize that to the screen, or you could press the plus button in the corner to start a new Safari session, right? And then, and in the process of that one extra button tap, it would remind you that you actually have these six windows open, and that maybe you should clear them up.
Okay.
Whereas today, you press Safari, and it just brings you back to one of the windows that exists. And that behavior can be maintained if you only ever have one window open. So if you are a casual user, I'll say that right finally. If you are a casual user and you're only doing Safari one window at a time, your experience won't change. It's only when you start spawning multiple windows that when you press Safari on the dock icon, it then does something different and actually helps you guide you through managing the multiple windows that you've opened, rather than kind of half pretending that it doesn't exist.
Yeah, and the last thing we'll say on this is that if the old way, like on iOS 12, if the way of multitasking works for you, then and you're okay with all of that, then it probably only gets better for you with iOS 13. But if you're like us and you see frustration there with how it works and you think it's getting clunkier and clunkier, even, you know, because you get more features, then you know you're not going to be happy with it, and maybe
we were hoping for a different approach with 13 versus what they did in 11. And what it is a add-on to what they did in 11.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And I also have kind of a distaste for when every software update just shifts how everything works. Because I think that there's investment in time and learning how things work, especially when they're hidden gesture-based. So it's never a good idea, in my opinion, to just take, okay, we've got a different idea this year. We think it's way better than last year. let's do that this year. And then next year you think, oh, we've got an even better idea. Let's totally change it 3 years in a row. I don't like that. And something as simple as like, where is the repeat songs button in the music app? Like that changes all the time. You know, they think they've got a better idea for that. So I don't think it's great to do that, but on the iPad, I think we are due for like a, let's do all these features in a different way that feels like if you were designing everything from day one with all these in mind, how would you do that? Like, say, this is the goal. Let's change how we get there.
The home screen still feels very disconnected from the multitasking experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like, the home screen is focused on this, like, one app at a time model. And then whenever you're not on the home screen, you can access all this multitasking stuff. So they need like a different way of unifying those concepts together. Because I think right now they try and keep the home screen as the one app at a time model to satisfy, you know, the mainstream user base who never use multiple windows or multiple apps side by side. And then it's like, oh, now that you're doing the side by side stuff, we'll give you the pro stuff there. But if you are in that flow, it becomes really frustrating when you have to keep going back to the home screen for things. And then it, you know, basically ignoring what you are, you know, ignoring your intent. So that unification was something I was hoping they would come to this year in 13, and now I just guess I put it on my list again for another year. We've all read some surprising online reviews. Whether you're trying to get a sweet deal on something you've been saving for or trying to find the best happy hour in town, it's generally a good idea to read the reviews first. So why should finding the right software for your business be any different? Read thousands of real software reviews and find the right software for your business at Capterra.com/happy hour. Not familiar with Capterra? Capterra is the leading free online resource to help you find the best software solution for your business. With over 950,000 reviews of products from real software users, discover everything you need to make an informed decision. Search more than 700 specific categories covering the entire range of business needs, from project management to email marketing, to even running your own yoga studio. No matter what kind of software you're looking for to get your business off the ground or to simply optimize your existing workflows, Capterra makes it easy to discover the right solution and fast. How do you get started? Go to Capterra.com and drill down into a subcategory like app design, home building, insurance, or banking. It's completely free to look around and explore what's available. Don't trawl the web with endless Google searches. Capterra brings everything together into one simple to browse directory. Join the millions of people who use Capterra each month to find the right tools for their business. Visit capterra.com/happy hour for free today. Find the right tools to make an informed software decision for your business. Capterra.com/happy hour. Capterra, CAPTERRA.com/happy hour. Capterra, software selection simplified.
All right, Mayo, in the last section today, I want to do for the first time ever, hashtag Ask9to5Mac, where we take questions from our listeners. And I know listeners have been asking for this for so long, and we've been reluctant to do it. But I'm starting to enjoy these. And I think I mentioned last week, it was especially listening to Stacktrace, where the questions were so different than what I hear on a lot of other podcasts that do this kind of thing, where I felt like it was more specific to those two hosts, Guy Rambo and John Sundell, that I thought, yeah, wonder what we'll get if we try this out. And so I'm quite happy with the amount of questions we had and you know what they are. So thanks to everyone who sent those in. I'll introduce each question, Mayo, and then we'll both discuss each one. So the first one comes from Steven Settler, I believe, and he's at Kingston2 on Twitter. He addresses this to you, so I'll let you have this one on your own. Why are all three, why all these years later, isn't there a reasonably priced Thunderbolt 3 dock? Is it too much to ask for a USB-A power pass through, the ability to daisy chain, and acceptable 4K at 60 hertz? What's your take there? And you replied on Twitter too, but what's your take on the show?
Yeah. I would say that the Thunderbolt 3 docks, even now, predominantly appeal to Apple MacBook customers, and until very recently, exclusively MacBook Pro customers. And these accessory manufacturers know that if you bought a MacBook Pro, you're probably not tight for cash. So they can probably get away with charging more money anyway. That's just market economics, right? They know the people that are buying these docks are people that have spent $2,000, $3,000, you know, even more potentially, on high-end expensive laptops, and they're probably willing to pay you know, or they at least have the funds to pay for high-end expensive accessories. So that's definitely like the market economic factor of the situation. There's also the problem that Thunderbolt 3 has not become commoditized yet. It's still not a big thing in the PC world. It's only just, right, like only recently become de facto on the Mac line. And I bet the volumes that these things sell them are still very low. And if you see that like the USB-C docks that are around, which are less capable, but often give what people want, they're a lot cheaper. You can get, you know, decent USB-C hubs for like $50, whereas I think the cheapest Thunderbolt 3 dock that Apple sells is $250. And you probably want the higher model than that, which is like $300. That is expensive, and it probably doesn't represent the true cost of the components. I believe that most of these docks are all sourced from like one manufacturer that's providing like the logic board for these, because they all basically do the same thing. I've had like three review units that you could almost, from different brands, that you can almost stack on top of each other, and the lineup of all the ports along the face like match up exactly. Like,
yeah,
it's almost like they're the same things in special casings. So I'm sure either that logic board person is selling, or that company that makes that stuff is still keeping the price high for these resellers that brand it, or the resellers are just making lots of money on them. That's why it's still expensive. Yes, it's $300 ish. I would still recommend people buy one if they do have like MacBook Pro situations where you're using it like a desktop for a lot of the time, right? Yeah. You're using your laptop at your desk every single day. I've been using a Thunderbolt 3 dock since I got my 2016 MacBook Pro, and you know, I'd never live without it. I sit down, I plug in one cable, I have displays, keyboard, mouse, power, charging, connection to Ethernet, like the whole works. I plug in one cable and I'm done. I would 100% recommend it. I know it's expensive. Just do it once. I there are a lot of people who go, oh, Thunderbolt 3 unreliable. I basically had no reliability issues. I don't think, maybe there were out the gate. Maybe I've been lucky. I think nowadays, at least the reliability issues have gone away, even if they still cost a fortune. But if you're in the market, if you have, you know, a laptop at your desk experience, just buy one. You'll be a lot happier.
Okay. The next question comes from Jason Garrity, and he's at ArchHeretic1 on Twitter. He asks us both, what next big product are you most excited for? I'll let you go first.
Near term, probably the 16-inch MacBook Pro.
Yeah, that's what I guess.
I've been sitting on this 2016 for, you know, 4 years now. I do work it to the bone. I do, you know, heavy ice development during the week, plus the blogging stuff. And it is my desktop Mac as well. Like, it's not just like, oh, the one I use when I go on traveling or I go out for a bit, right? This is my day-to-day computer. I use it every single day. When I bought the 2016, I basically just bought the base model. So it has only 256 gigs of storage, which I push up against the limit constantly nowadays. The keyboard has been problematic since day one. I have the first keyboard that it came with, because I've never had a good opportunity to get it replaced, because I use it every day, as I just mentioned. So, and I haven't been interested in any of these like fake generations, because I've been worried about keyboard anxiety. Mm-hmm. B, I think Apple could do an even nicer design nowadays with like thinner bezels, or just, you know, make it black. That'd be cool. Like in like space, like not space gray, but like proper black, like matte black. That'd be just cool to look at. It'd be more powerful nowadays. And yeah, it's probably going to be expensive. I paid, I think, $2,300 for this one. And the 16-inch is probably going to come in at, you know, around three, even if it's slightly cheaper. The one with a decent upgrade that you want would probably be around three anyway. Hey, I do this stuff for a living. I'm you know, on the edge of wanting a new laptop. So that would be my current thing that I'm most anticipating to see and hopefully be happy with.
Yeah, I think, I know your last comment was about me. I think our job excuses me from trying different MacBooks and iPads and iPhone screen sizes, because it makes me more informed about each one. And if I was just a normal consumer, there's no way I would do this. But because of the nature of our jobs, it is beneficial to entertain that urge for me to make a swap mid-cycle. Yeah, that's what I have. Now, back to the question, what we're most excited about. I would say the Apple Watch Series 5 this fall, just because it's such a big curiosity of like what is coming. And I've bought every new Apple Watch on day one since the original shipped. And I always get benefit from whatever performance they can eke out or new features that they offer. I'm always like, I literally got into health and fitness because that was a feature of the first Apple Watch. And it took a lot of months for me to spark that interest. But I was just like, these activity rings, what are they all about? And maybe I should start a streak. And that's gone so many places for me that I'm happy about. So the Series 5. The next question, though, I think we'll talk more about that. So this comes from Matt Hamilton, who is at Matt M. Hamilton on Twitter. And he asked, Apple Watch Series 5 rumors have been quiet. Do you think there will be a hardware upgrade this fall? And we've kind of been touched on this in recent episodes. I think the most recent episode we do a little bit, and that was released after this question came about. But I think, like, if I had to guess right now, this is not reporting. Like, it's not like we know these things, but just the lack of rumors. I don't think we've had a cycle this quiet so much where there's not a single thing besides ceramic casing that's rumored this year. I mean, and that comes by way of Kuo, who is reliable, and his other detail was ECG in more countries, and they've tackled that. But it feels like this year, I'm at least for me, to adjust to my expectations and not be disappointed, it feels like there might not be a Series 5 this year. Like, we could go all the way to next fall for Series 5, and there's a lot rumored there. Like, Mark Gurman at Bloomberg says sleep tracking as soon as next year. For the Series, you know, we would think 6, but that could be 5. there's the micro LED screen display, which that could afford new ways to pack in more battery. Or the other scenario is to change the depth, you know, how thick the watch is if it's thinner. So it feels like there's a lot of things they could do next year that are rumored for next year and not this year. And micro LED, like, maybe that has a factor on an always on display for showing the time. You know, sleep tracking is a very big one that people want to know about. So for Series 5, like, you know, this year, if there's an update and it's just a speed boost, then a lot of people will buy that one and then miss out on buying next year. So that's one factor, is you kind of eat into this, the benefit of, like, what you'll get next year if there is a new one this year. But they do a new one every year since the Series 1 and 2. So, it feels like this year that there might not be one, and I'm having to get used to that idea. And if you look back to the Apple Watch first generation, that was on the market for 18 months. And 24, if you count the announcement before it actually launched. And they spent much of that first year and a half just literally launching it in new countries. Like, you know, you got watchOS 2, for Apple Watch, you know, the first in Apple Watch, I think. And that made it feel faster. But so much of that time was spent on, this is, Apple Watch will now be available in this country, in that country. And we've had,
I mean, it took them like 4 months to be regularly available in the US.
Yeah. And with Series 3, there was there's a lot of that with LTE, but not every watch is LTE. With Series 4, I think the version of that has been, they're still launching new countries for the electrocardiogram app, which is a big part of that Apple Watch. So you could say there's some similarities there where you might want to keep the Series 4 on the market for longer because you're still kind of rampant rolling it out for the first time. And the Series 3 is aged pretty well, I think. You know, I think it's okay to continue selling that one. Maybe in the fall, they'd give a price drop to the Series 4. The only problem with that, I think, is when they do have a big upgrade next year, do they really want to lower the price and then take it back up again? So maybe they'll hold on to the same price. And then with the Series 3, like, maybe there's an opportunity there. So with the first generation Apple Watch, it went away after 18 months, and the Series 1 came out, which was just the first gen watch, but with the new
S1P.
S1P. It was the new chip from the Series 2 watch, but it didn't have GPS. So it had the same speed as the Series 2. And that was kind of an admission that the first generation watch was just too slow. So they fixed that problem, and they continued selling the same casing and everything. You just didn't get GPS. So if you look at Series 3, it's held up really well with watchOS 5 for all its life. And then this fall, watchOS 6. Like, I don't think even the Series 4 is slow on watchOS 6. But the Series 3, it came with watchOS 4, right? And then watchOS 5 came to it. However, maybe you want to address the speed situation with the Series 3, similar to how you did with the first generation to Series 1, where it's like basically the same watch, but you just bump the speed up. Because there's no competition for the Apple Watch in the smartwatch space. Like, there are fitness trackers that do different things, but you just don't have the competition. So, like, Apple literally could take a year off and not get beat, I think. And if they just refresh the current lineup with, like, new colors and maybe new speed for the Series 3, I think that'd be okay. And lastly, the Series 4 just looks... It still looks new in the way that the iPhone X still looks new. You know,
Yeah. You
got a new design. It's a big leap forward. So I think there's room to spare. If they do have a Series 5, I'll be surprised and I'll be happy. And I'll buy it and next year's watch because that's the one thing I want every year. But that's it. Do you have anything on this?
Yeah, I mostly agree with what you said. I think that it's just too quiet for there to be anything major for the watch hardware this year. Like, maybe there is a revision. Maybe it's just a speed bump. I mean, we're already coming off a year of a big design change, right, in Series 4 anyway. So this following year, we wouldn't expect, you know, a chassis redesign, really.
Right.
So they could just come through with some new case materials. Obviously, we expect ceramic. Maybe there's another one they do that's different to what they offer now, and they just carry on that through the holiday season. Maybe there's, like, a 2019 MacBook Air-style update to it, where it gets, like, one tiny little feature, like True Tone, and then maybe the price goes down a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about it. It's almost August and we haven't heard like one definitive, oh, you know, that's a hardware feature, you know, that isn't cosmetic for the watch. So yeah, it definitely just seems like a quiet year.
For Series 3, we knew GPS for a long time. And for Series 4, we knew redesign for a long time. We just don't have that for Series 5 yet. And maybe it means there isn't one this year. We'll see. Next up is from Julian Fox Emoji, who is at JFUCHS98 on Twitter. He wants to know, what are the current HomePod expectations? I don't want to buy one if a new one is coming this fall. And I think you've got a good answer for this.
I reckon the HomePod hardware that we know today will carry on being sold for a while. They price dropped it just after June, so by $50, so now it's $299, which is a pretty good price for what it is. You know, maybe it should be $250, but it's getting there. I don't think there will be a hardware update to the HomePod. There may be an addition to the lineup, like HomePod Mini or something. Even that, though, we haven't heard, you know, anything concrete about at the moment. So even that's, you know, off the table. I think what you see for the HomePod this year is the software changes. And they've got an A8 chip in there. They've got, you know, very good speakers, hardware, very good bass and stuff. Like, I think they can just carry on with the current HomePod for, you know, another 1, 2, 3 years, even just with software improvements. Like, what we're getting this year, we're getting multi-user, multi-voice detection, and stuff like that. And, you know, there's plenty more of those things you could list off that they could do perfectly well with current hardware and just deliver a software update. So I think that's... I if you want a HomePod, I'd just buy one at the moment. I don't think there's a danger of them, you know, doing a Rev 2 model in September.
Yeah, when the software update comes out this fall, it will absolutely be the best time to buy a HomePod in terms of features because it will be able to do the most. And then it's also the lowest price from Apple since they did the price drop. But my advice would be if you're really concerned about the price and not wanting to pay retail price, you know, if there's something new coming, there is benefit in having multiple HomePods, but look for a sale. Like 9to5 Toys is great to follow for this because if you can pay less than even the retail price for a HomePod, then you feel like you're kind of, you know, getting one over on Apple a little bit. And so even if you buy one like refurbished or used, you know, a HomePod either works or it doesn't. So there's not a big risk there. And, you know, you can find some good used deals on like eBay and maybe Facebook Marketplace. So I check that out if you're really concerned about the price and being, you know, a new model coming later. I'm still waiting for that Beats AirPlay 2 speaker. Tyler Brassfield, who is at tbrass84 on Twitter and bought my old iPhone. He wants to know, right now I use iTunes home sharing to our Apple TVs in the house with library stored on an AirPort Extreme time capsule. What would be the pros and cons to switching to Plex on something like Synology DS218 Plus? Always scared to move on to a new setup when you've got one years in the existing. And I think the DS218 Plus is what I use, right? You know more than
yeah,
me.
Yeah.
What's knowledge?
Yeah. Similar. Like, yeah.
Okay.
What I would say firstly is in your question, you basically named three deprecated technologies.
Yeah.
the AirPort, iTunes, and home sharing. Like, home sharing is clearly on the way out and not a primary focus for Apple in 2019, especially as TV Plus and TV channels come out. They want you to subscribe to those and not just have loads of local files on your disk and and stream them.
And even like iTunes in the cloud for purchase content, that's been a fix for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They want you, they're on the cloud, right? Home sharing dates back to what, 2009, and basically hasn't been touched since it was introduced.
Yeah.
And it works okay, but I promise you, you'll be way happier if you switch to a Plex setup. Like the Plex apps are really, really good, especially on Apple TV, you know, which is one of the things you mentioned. The computer's app on tvOS, which is how you access home sharing content, is terrible. Like, it is almost like a file browser. It's really, really bad. It's nowhere, and it doesn't integrate with the TV app, right? So Up Next and all that stuff, you don't get any of that. It's a very bad interface to home sharing. Plex will give you a TV app-like experience for your entire Plex library. You can get Up Next. You get recommendations. When new episodes get synced to the server, they can show up and show, like, on deck, these are the things you should watch now and just carry on your series. You can get album art, you know, metadata, film trailers. If you upload it, if you have a movie on there, you can even, you know, get, like, featurettes and bonus content show up below. You get ratings, reviews. It's like having the TV app for your own media library in a way that the computer's app really isn't. And I'm sure when September rolls around, Plex will be there very quickly with an update to support, like, multiple users on tvOS 13, the new top shelf UI, all of that stuff. And, you know, meanwhile, the computer's app on tvOS is basically untouched, and it relies on technology that's, you know, practically a decade old. So Plex is way better. The Synology model that you mentioned is perfectly fine for that use case. You just stick hard drives in it. You can sync files across. It's really not that difficult to just run a Synology just for Plex. Like, you go into the web UI once, you install Plex from the thing. You can basically just leave it from then on now and occasionally do software updates. Like, it's not a big problem. I've never had reliability issues. I assume you get more reliability issues with, like, an AirPort Extreme now, as that goes out the window, just like,
and that hard drive in the time capsule going to fail.
Connectivity,
yeah.
You can carry it, and if you get a Synology box and you run Plex on it, you can carry on using your AirPort Extreme for Wi-Fi if you want to. Just disconnect the hard drive from it, and then, you know, when that finally dies or gets abandoned by Apple, you can get a new Wi-Fi router, but you don't have to. You can just download the apps for free on TV. On Plex, there's a Plex is a pay. It has a free tier. I think the paid app is good for, like, if you want to do offline downloads or multiple users. And they offer, like, monthly plans, which are like $10 a month. And there's, like, a yearly plan, which is $99. And so, you know, if you're going to use Plex for more than 1 year, you're already making money just buying lifetime. Plex isn't like a small company, right? Like, they're a pretty big operation. They've been around for a while now. I think you're pretty safe to just buy a lifetime plan. You buy it once, it's a one-time fee, and you never have to think about it again. There's no ads or weirdness. They have, like, they occasionally add these, like, podcast suggestions or news hubs and all this stuff that you probably don't want, but they let you turn all that off in the settings if you want to, and you can just focus on TV shows and movies and be very, 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 very happy. And if you want to try it out, like, you don't have to buy the hardware up front, just connect a hard drive to your Mac, install Plex on your Mac, put some files on there, give it a go, see if you like it, and then you can buy, like, a NAS to run 24/7, for instance.
Yeah, another thing I would say is so, of course, the time capsule hard drive is a spinning disk hard drive. It's going to fail eventually. It's just a matter of when. We all know that. You're capped out at whatever the storage is in that. And with a Synology, you can up the storage. Like, you know, I think I went from, like, 4 terabytes to 8 terabytes recently. And it's just because you can just swap out the drives and add as storage gets cheaper. It's also a hard disk drive that will fail eventually, but you can upgrade those every time. Whereas in the time capsule, you're kind of locked into that one drive for forever.
And if you get, like, a two or a four bay, which, and I think the TU18 Plus is a two bay, you can use both drives, either just more and more storage, or you can just use one drive as a backup as the other one. So if the hard drive fails, you can carry on using it and just swap out the other hard drive that stopped working. Like, I have 2 8-terabyte drives in there at the moment, but I only use 1 8-terabyte. The other one just backs it up. And I have Time Machine running on that as well as Plex.
Yeah, me too. And then lastly, for home sharing, I think you're limited with home sharing to just being on the Wi-Fi network, right? But with Plex and Synology, then you open the door of seeing this content remotely. And I do the Plex lifetime subscription where I paid one time and then I've got it for forever. And people in my close family that live around me, like my brother and my sister, and you know, even people that live in other states, like another sister, we all share Plex with each other. And so I'm able to just to put a video in and they can see it on their Plex app. And like, there's a Plex client for everything. So suddenly with home sharing, it's like literally in your home. With Plex, it's like wherever you go, you know, and the paid tier is not that bad if you just do like a one-time payment to unlock it for forever. So I'm a big proponent of that. Next up is from Cletus Fetus on Twitter, who is at Cletus Fetus. He's got a few good questions here today. His question is, has there been any tech product you regret buying? What about a tech product you regret not buying? And I'll start first here.
You've never regretted anything, right?
With the tech, like, I mean, trying different things is different, but like the one regret that I've got is spending money to go from an iPhone 10 to an iPhone 10s. Like, and I tried the Max for a few months, and that was experimental, you know, and I got experience from that, but I ended up happier with just the 10s. And the upgrade path there, like just the things that you get year over year are just so slim, because the 10 was meant to be like the futuristic phone alongside the iPhone 8, and it was. But next to the 10, the 10s is not that comparison. And you know, iPhone 7 to iPhone 10 was a humongous jump. But again, like it's so marginal, the improvements that you get from a 10 to a 10s. I've had friends that are like, I want that camera. And that's true. But and it feels like that's going to be the case for the 11 this year, unless there's something that stands out to you specifically. But for me, it's that. And then regret not buying. That was an interesting angle on this. Partly, it's like older products that I didn't have access to because I was a kid or something, or didn't, you know, I wasn't alive yet. And with those, like, you can just, I didn't have the original iPad or iPhone, but a Happy Hour listener sold them to me, and I'm so thankful. And it's like, they're great for the collection. And often, like, you know, you weren't going to buy an iPhone 5C if you wanted the 5S, but wait a few years and then they're really cheap to buy secondhand if you want to collect them. So that's really it, is like, there are some things that come along that I regret. I might want to buy it for collector's sake, and don't, but that's about it. And then you can usually get this cheaper later anyway. What about you?
Yeah. I have thought long and hard about this question, and there was nothing that comes to mind that I regretted buying, because even if there was something, I probably just sold it again, basically got my money back.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, I haven't really had any like huge, and I try and be more, I'm more conservative than you in buying stuff, mm-hmm. right, anyway, so... Yeah. I try not to buy stuff without thinking that I actually want it. For instance, I didn't buy a 10S, right?
So, right. That's the right call.
Yeah. In terms of things I regret not buying, and this is such a stupid answer, but I'm going to say it. The Design in California book.
Oh, yeah. I got it. I can relate.
Yeah, and it's like, now Johnny's gone, it's like, you know, I kind of want that book, and it's still out of stock and stuff, and it's like, you know, I could probably find one still for, but now it's like, now it feels old because it's not updated with any of the new phones or anything in it. Yeah. So I regret not buying it when it was new.
So I didn't buy it for myself, it was a gift, and because it was a gift, the person did not buy me, what was it, like 300 versus 200 or something like that.
Yeah.
I didn't get the really big version. I just got the big version, which is really cool though. It's still a great thing to own. And I keep it on my desk, my second desk, because it's like, you know, to open it now, I said this on the podcast whenever I got it that year. It was like, this will only get better with time. Like whatever value it has today, it'll be way more sentimental in 3, 5 years, 10 years. And that's only been true for me. It's like, oh, this stuff is like, there's two revisions since then, you know, and even things that were like at the end of the book that were brand new, you just, you know, those get updated, like the Mac Pro and the first Apple Watch, like with the exploded view of like the internals, like there's some really cool stuff there. And you can find all the images online and you can find videos of like people walking through every page of the book, but to own it, it is nice. And
yeah. It's very superficial and mm-hmm. it's definitely expensive, but you know, I kind of think I'd be happy now if I actually owned one.
Yeah, I've got that, and I've got the Hodinkee. You know, they're like a luxury watch site. They had a print magazine issued which had Johnny Ive on the cover, and then an extended interview with him in there. And I've got that next to my design book in an Apple book, Design in California book. And I love those two things. There's a couple more things. I've also got the Vogue magazine that had the first Apple Watch ad in print. I got that to collect. There was the Johnny. Do you remember the Johnny Ive wallpaper? Asterix.
Oh yeah, the white magazine.
Yeah, I know our colleague Michael Stever wants that and doesn't have it. That's his answer for regrets not buying. But all right, the next question is from at Braden R. Newell on Twitter, and he's at Braden _ Newell on Twitter. He wants to know for me what was the most memorable experience working at the Apple Store. And I probably can't just pick one, so I'll just go through a few that you know. I recall, like, one was seeing John Browett walk through the store. and so that was like when I was hired, the retail chief, Ron Johnson had left already for JCPenney. And there was no one yet. Like, there's no one person in leadership for the longest time. And then John Browett was hired, and then he only lasted for a year. But before he was fired, he did come to our store in Boca Raton and had a meeting with some of the top people at the store, kind of offsite where our lunch break room was. So that was just neat to see, like, at the time, the top person in the chain besides the CEO.
Had he ruined the Apple Store by the time that you saw him?
there were all the New York Times stories about pay and situations. So yeah, but it's neat. I didn't get to talk to him. It was neat to see him, and it was even more like a collective memory when he was fired. It's like, oh, I saw him. Yeah.
I mean, that's your first Apple executive sighting, right, in your life.
That's true. Only followed up by Johnny Ive and Tim Cook and everyone else. But you're right about that. The first thing that came to mind for me, though, was there was one night after the store closed where a few people, including me, were involved in, like, filming a video that I think was, like, promotional material internally. It was, like, a sketch kind of thing. And it was just like my role in that was like probably like to hold a light or something. But just being in the Apple Store after dark, you know, when there's no customers in there, was neat. Seeing the iPad 3 in person before that was released to the public, because it was like the morning of the launch, and like seeing a Retina display on an iPad for the first time, you know, like tech reviewers had seen it, but like to see it before a customer saw it was kind of neat and special. And then finally, this kind of goes back to your Johnny Ive answer a second ago. Whenever Steve Jobs died, I was working in the Apple Store, and I remember the day and the moment, because I was moving a couch to the second floor of a condo in Florida, and my grandparents were watching CBS Evening News on TV. And it was like breaking news that Steve Jobs had passed away. And so, like, you know, we stopped in the process and just, like, you know, got glued to the TV. So that was one thing. But then when there was the Steve Jobs funeral that was like, Johnny Ive spoke, Tim Cook spoke, mm-hmm. We closed the store down. Like, every Apple Store stopped, you know, it was planned ahead of time, and like customers were kind of upset about it. But like,
yeah, just to be clear, this wasn't the funeral. This was like a commemoration.
Yeah.
They held on campus. It was like, right. Coldplay play and stuff like that.
Like a celebration.
The funeral was private.
Right. It was like a celebration of life at Apple.
Yeah.
And that was, we closed the stores for that like hour and a half or so. And people lined up, but I was okay. And we like blacked out the windows so no one could see it. And we had a big video screen before like video walls to like project to. And we watched like the live stream from Cupertino at Infinite Loop. And to see that live, you know, not in person, but just to see it live, like, you know, not every pedestrian could do that. But if you worked at Apple Retail at the time, you could. And so to have that, you know, in my memory, it was one thing just weird to have the store closed in the middle of the day like that, but then to see like Johnny Ive speak about Steve Jobs, and to see Tim Cook speak about Steve Jobs. I'm sure you can see it on YouTube now.
Yeah, I've watched it on YouTube.
Yeah, but live in the moment, it's like the closest thing to being there, which was really special and a great thing to experience at the time, as sad as it was, you know, but it was a celebration of life. Next up from Braden is another question we wanted to include, which is, what does the behind-the-scenes process look like when communicating with Apple PR and other companies for demo units? Other companies, it's pretty normal. You know, it's just boring phone calls, emails, video calls. Things show up in the mail. You get to use them. Sometimes you send them back. Sometimes you keep them. But, you know, you don't always want to keep them, depending on what it is. With Apple PR, how would you put it?
Well, with other companies, you send an email and they reply. And with Apple PR, you send an email and 99 times out of 100, they don't reply.
Yeah, they get the email.
That's your summary.
Yeah, we know that they get the email every time, but there's got to be a reason to reply to it. And so it's pretty boring. It's a lot of email. It's a lot of returned emails. Occasionally there's a phone call involved. Occasionally there's something in person, but you know, it is neat to experience it. And this is a cool job. But mostly it's like disheartening because you're like, and it's tricky too with like having exclusive stories that, you know, they don't want shared ahead of time. And you've got to balance that with PR, and you're never going to favor, you know, a relationship with a company versus, you know, what readers want, which is what's happening next and what, you know, that kind of thing. So I'd say it's like a little bit uncomfortable, but when it's healthy and it goes well, it's kind of exhilarating for obvious reasons.
Yeah, it's cool when you do get an answer.
Yeah, yeah. And finally, this comes from Cletus Fetus again, and he says, what was the moment you guys knew you'd be friends and like, and the entire story of the start of the podcast? And this is to both of us. And this is what we spent like 30 minutes before at recording last week trying to figure it out. So like, it's interesting to us. What have you got?
Yeah, so at least in terms of when the podcast span up, Happy Hour was running before I was at 9to5Mac,
mm-hmm.
Before, and then Zach was kind of like coming in as a, you know, as a friend almost, right? Like you weren't even working there, right, at the start.
Yeah, so Seth Weintraub, who is the editor-in-chief and publisher of 9to5Mac, he got together the writers, which included Mark Gurman at the time and Jordan Kahn, who is still here on ads and does the partners program. And I believe Elise Betters, who works and part of CBS now, and maybe some other folks, but it was mostly meant to be, it was mostly like a Google Hangouts live on Friday night or, you know, Friday at 5 p.m. And you could see the live conversation and everything. And people like that. But for us, it was never something that we could do in the way that we wanted to, you know, and I think the request for that died down after people, you know, liked the format of this show. But I was a guest one episode on video and I wasn't an employee yet. And I think it went well. Scott Buscemi hosted those as well. And then there was a like 3-episode podcast run that didn't go anywhere. And then this is like the third iteration, but it's like the longest going iteration of Happy Hour began with Seth, Dom Esposito, who has a YouTube channel who worked for us at the time on video, and me for like a few episodes, and Mark Gurman was there too. And when did you come about?
Yeah, so I guested on a few episodes. At that point, I joined 9to5Mac in like April 2013, mm-hmm. but
same
shy or whatever. And like you went in day to day, right? And
yes.
I was just like, you know, an occasional contributor, and I became more active over time. Mm-hmm. But I was on a few. I was, you know, I was like first year uni still back then, but I was on a few like of the, because back there was a couple of hangouts I remember being on, and then it changed to just a raw audio show for a few episodes. But essentially, by the time we got to episode like 67, it had converged on this format that you hear today,
yes.
Me and you,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. You were a frequent guest, but you were not a co-host, as you we'd say now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and by around that time, me and you had basically decided that we were going to commit to this and do it properly. Because even before those episodes, it wasn't even like weekly for a while, right? It was just kind of when people felt like it. And
yeah.
We have, you know, successfully done a show every single week for, you know, more than 4 years now, like closing on 5 years. We've done a show every single week, basically yeah. This format, me and you.
Yeah, I've missed a couple episodes. One week, my brother was in the hospital, and it was an emergency situation, so I was away that week and for that situation. And then another week, I had a...
Yeah, I've been away like 2 or 3 times.
Yeah, another week.
Since episode 67.
Yeah, another week, I had a baby, so it was away that week too. But in the early days, like, I mean, I was on every one, but I was a guest, and Dom carried us for several episodes, you know. But I've had a lot of fun since Dom moved on to just focus on his own YouTube channel, just you and I. And the reason this works for us is that if you can't tell on air, I think we like each other, right? Like, you know,
yeah,
we spend most days on iMessage, you know. We have similar takes on things, and you know, sometimes
yeah, I this question was interesting because, you know, answering when do we first become friends is a hard question. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know how many people of the listeners know this, but me and you have still never met in person.
Mm-hmm. Because of different continents,
right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's hard, right? But yep. It just turned out that we were, you know, writing on the same site, and at some point we were chatting in the private chat. Back then it was HipChat before we moved to Slack.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we got along. We kind of knew each other from the podcast. We did a few episodes of the podcast together. We generally had not the same opinion, but I think we worked out that we were on, you know, along the same lines.
Yeah.
And basically it went from there, and we never had an argument. So that's how it happened. It obviously happened very organically, and there wasn't like one moment where it was like, you know, me and you are friends now. It just kind of developed by itself.
Yeah.
And a lot of it happened because of this show, right? Like,
totally.
But when, at the time when we were committing to do it weekly, you know, I think at that time we were still kind of more like, you know, just more like business friends, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
and then from there it just slowly developed into us, you know, iMessaging in private, iMessaging every day, and then this, right?
Like,
it's a funny path.
Yeah, I recall in those first like few episodes of this run of the podcast that when you weren't on every episode, I think the first time I encouraged the other people on the show, let's have May on this week. I think he can bring something to the podcast. And that was part selfishly because I didn't want to have to carry the show as much, you know, as a talking head. And I would push, let's have May back again this week, you know? And so it really was just like whoever's around available to do a show. It could be any number of hosts or guests that week. And I'm so happy that it's been way easier to do every week. Once it was just you and I, you know, occasionally, rarely have someone even from 9to5 Mac on to talk things, but I'm happy with that, and it has been fun to look back at like the origin there, because what are we at, like 257? So that's a lot of weeks to do this. We're growing together.
Maybe when we do finally meet in person, we'll hate each other and never talk to each other ever again.
I recall the first time I met Mark Gurman in person, first of many times, but we shared a hotel room, and I arrived in San Francisco at like 11:30 p.m. and we'd just been iMessaged friends from being colleagues and friends before that, so that when we met in person, there was no awkwardness to it, and there was no like let's meet for real, like there's a different dynamic. It was just like, it's the same guy that I know, you know, from iMessage or from talking on FaceTime. So I think we'll be all right if it ever happens. All right, and that is the Happy Hour podcast for this week. Thanks to all our listeners who contributed hashtag Ask9to5Mac questions on Twitter. You can just use that hashtag, and we'll see it in our column on TweetDeck. You can mention us if you want to, especially if you want to specify who the question's for. But even just sending a tweet out with that hashtag, we'll see it, and we'll consider it for the show in the future. And I also want to say so we're recording this on the Thursday before the show comes out. We're probably going to put it on Tuesday next week. On Wednesday of next week, I'll have the second episode or the third episode of my new Watch Time podcast out. And I can say the guest is Alex Cox from Cards Against Humanity and Dubai Friday and lots of other podcasts. And this is where it gets kind of real. So far we had the episode with me and you, Mayo, which I thought
it was rubbish.
I felt like it was like warming up, you know, we're filling out the format. I liked it. And then I had on a good friend of mine, Jacob Knight, in the second episode to talk about his fitness journey. And I don't know Alex Cox very well, and so I was nervous about it. And I also had told her like what I wanted to talk about was like deeply personal, but I just felt like she was the right person to have that talk with. And so I think the episode went really well. It does get personal and a little bit heavy, but it's balanced with, like, you know, Alex Cox is a lot of fun if you know her. And I think we had a great conversation. So check out Watch Time this week. If you haven't heard an episode yet, you can subscribe and catch up. And thanks for everyone who does listen to that podcast as well. We've got more coming for this season before it wraps up for the year. And also, things we always say, please star us on Overcast to help people discover the show. Please rate, review, and subscribe in iTunes or Apple Podcasts. Same situation where we love the reviews, we love the feedback, and it helps more people discover the show. And you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Apollo Zach. Benjamin, you're on Twitter at
BZA Mayo.
And also follow 9to5 Mac on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube at 9to5 Mac. And if you have any feedback for the show, you can email us at happyhour@9to5mac.com. And we'll be back next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye.